How well does Indian healthcare treat your pain? How well does it help mitigate suffering? Morphine, for example, is ridiculously inexpensive and can help millions of Indians with unimaginable pain, but it's accessible to less than 2% of those who deserve it. Dr. M.R. Rajagopal, the chairman of Pallium India, talks to us about palliative care and why we must urgently prioritize and mainstream it in Indian health. Welcome to the Pragati Podcast, a weekly talk show on public policy, economics, and international relations. We take a step back from noisy political debates and dive into rich conversations on India and the world. I am your host, Pavan Srinath. We'll start this episode's conversation after a short break. Hi, I'm Pavan Srinath and welcome to the Pragati Podcast. It is my privilege today to talk to Dr. M.R. Rajagopal about palliative care, what it means, and how we can ease enormous suffering and pain for many people across India. We are recording this in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic, where palliative care has only become more important in the country. Dr. Rajagopal is the founder chairman of Pallium India and director of the Trivandrum Institute of Palliative Sciences, which is a WHO collaborating center for training and policy on access to pain relief. Dr. Rajagopal has worked through the length of his career to establish palliative care and its importance in India, provide relief to innumerable Indians both directly and indirectly through his various efforts, and was also honored with a Padma Shri by the Republic of India in 2018 for his tireless efforts. Dr. Rajagopal, welcome to the Pragati Podcast.
Thank you very much, Pavan. This is a privilege to be part of this.
The privilege is still mine, Dr. Raj. So today I want to start by asking that, first of all, in India, we conflate public health with healthcare. And even when we look at public health and healthcare, we focus extensively on curative healthcare, and that too in the super specialized hospitals that are there, especially in our big cities. At our best, sometimes we look at primary health care, we look at some vaccination, some preventive health. Why do we stop here? And where does palliative care come in?
I'm glad you asked the question, Pavan. It is very significant because for 72 years, we have had this definition of health, never challenged, accepted all this time. That health is not only absence of a disease or infirmity, but is physical, social, and mental well-being. The well-being is hardly taken care of. As you mentioned, most of the effort of healthcare, whether it's primary, secondary, or tertiary, is in diagnosis and cure, with a little bit of prevention on the side. Right now, with the COVID-19 crisis, the prevention has become more important visibly. But still, it is still only on diseases. We don't take into consideration true health in the sense of physical, mental, and social well-being. If we did, we'd be giving more attention to how much a suffering there is. What does the average human being go through? What are the elements of his physical suffering, social suffering, mental suffering? Now, healthcare, to be truly healthcare, will have to take into consideration the suffering caused by the health issue and its prevention and management. That when you do not take suffering into consideration, not only do we not relieve suffering, we actually perpetuate suffering. Let me take one example. In 2018, British Medical Journal published an article which brings out the fact that in India, in 1 year, 55 million Indians are pushed below poverty line. 55 is more than 4% of India's population pushed below poverty line by catastrophic health expenditure. And in such instances, not only is the healthcare system not relieving suffering, it's becoming part of the problem.
an idea that is explored by Dr. Atul Gawande in the US, where from an American perspective, he says that up to perhaps 50% of the medical expenditure on a person might happen in the last 2 weeks of their lives. I fully concede that it's very important for some people. Even if one extra day you get to spend with them, it means a lot. But when there is so much pain and suffering, is there something we are truly missing out in all of this?
I'm glad you brought out that issue of end of life, about the cost of treatment in terms of money. But let's also talk about the cost in terms of human suffering. Yes, I want my loved ones to live as long as possible. But I want them to live reasonably well. I do not consider it a privilege if my life or my loved ones' lives are stretched out in terms of the dying process, which instead of one day becomes 3 weeks or 3 months on an artificial ventilator, isolated in a cold intensive care room, surrounded by machines and bleeps, with physical suffering inflicted by the numerous interventions, not only needles, but also a tube poked into your windpipe, and also repeated catheters pushed into your most sensitive part of the body, the breathing tube, to support mucus. And what do we achieve by that prolongation of suffering? What do we achieve by those added few days of heartbeat? Is that really living, or is it really dying? And instead of dying in a process of 3 days, you die every moment for 3 months. I wouldn't want that. I wouldn't want that to happen to me. I wouldn't want that to happen to any other people that I love. I wouldn't want that to happen to any human being. True, sometimes you are not sure whether the intensive care can bring the person back to life. I can understand that. But when it seems fairly certain that treatment is likely to be futile, I think we has to accept death as the inevitable consequence of life and allow a human being to leave the world with as much of comfort as possible, receiving as much of love as possible, and with as much of dignity as possible. I think that's frightfully important. Palliative care comes in here because, as Atul Gawande said, that always tries to improve the life in quality and quantity, but when the time comes, accepts death and infuses dignity and comfort into it.
Certainly. Dr. Raj, I really want to try and unpack what palliative care is and where all it is applicable.
In 2014, the World Health Assembly, that's a decision-making body of the World Health Organization, brought out a resolution which recommends that palliative care is to be integrated into all healthcare across the continuum of care from the beginning to the end at all levels of healthcare, primary, secondary, and tertiary. This continuum means that palliative care also, along with treatment of the disease, has to start when serious health-related suffering starts. Which means also that every doctor has to learn the fundamentals of palliative care, how to provide pain relief from other symptoms, and how to provide basic psychological and social support.
Could you give us some examples? I mean, we are born. I know that at least now people are realizing that childbirth can be a very, very traumatic experience for many people. And the idea of PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder is something that many, many mothers have to face. So from that process all the way to our final years, could you give us a few examples of where you see palliative care making a dramatic difference on the quality of somebody's life?
You asked about the childbirth and post-traumatic stress disorder. Why do we have the evidence of a disorder or a disease to make us act? It's absolutely true. We, the medical system, ordinarily takes into consideration measurable, visible, diseases, something that can be seen on a screen, something that can be cut out or burned, we are more interested in that. You cannot see post-traumatic stress disorder on an MRI scan. Therefore, we ignore it. There are many interventions in medical science where you do an operation, you do any procedure for investigation, etc., etc., where you can cause severe pain, and we have clear proof that that has a negative impact on the person for the rest of their life. Similarly, you keep somebody in an intensive care unit without adequate pain relief, without adequate sedation. 1/3 of all people get delirious. 2/3 of all elderly get delirious. Many get agitated. And we have proof that this isolation and intensive care also increases the chance of post-traumatic stress disorder. Therefore, we have evidence that it causes long-lasting damage. But my question is, why do we need evidence of long-lasting damage to relieve suffering? If I am suffering today, I believe the healthcare system has a responsibility to treat it, because this is accepted in the fundamental medical ethics. That's a physician's primary responsibility is to mitigate suffering. True, post-traumatic stress disorder is an important reason why pain should be treated, suffering should be treated. But anyway, suffering is suffering and needs to be treated.
I couldn't agree with you more, Dr. Raj. Could you give us a contrast between the needs of palliative care in the West, be it the United States, UK or elsewhere, and India, the need and the current amount of palliative care focus that is there in both?
With your permission, I would rather have the comparison with Western European countries and India. Western European countries, because that's where there is believed to be optimal access to healthcare. And healthcare there includes palliative care. Now, the comparison within India is in two means. One, very clear, it is simply not available for 98% of the needy. Palliative care reaches only about 2% of the needy in India. But there is also another important point. What is palliative care also depends on the social and economic realities of this country. Where primary health care is very deficient, palliative care has actually to compensate for that. So in a developing country like India, the palliative care physician cannot do exactly only what a palliative care physician would do in the UK or in Germany or in France. We may have to look after basic needs. If I may drop an example, we found this young woman, single parent with a 12-year-old boy. She was blind, having had juvenile diabetes from childhood. She had a diabetic foot, and later we found that the pus had crept almost as much as the knee. She had uncontrolled diabetes, was at risk of losing that leg. Now, that's really not an issue for palliative care to sort out in the UK or Germany. There is an existing primary healthcare system and secondary and tertiary healthcare systems which would take care of that problem. But here, that takes care of some common disorders. It doesn't really make allowances for these extreme situations. What should we have done? Saying that, look, your problems are diabetes and the resultant complications. You can get treatment in the government hospitals. Go there. That would be making a mockery of my profession, because I know that there is no social support system available to her to enable her to access what is there in the government system. And anyway, what is there in the government system was simply not enough for her. She needed expert attention to her leg, to her diabetes. So what did we do? We took her under our wings. We became part of her family, like we do for a lot of people. Made sure that she got that primary care that she needed. Got her diabetes controlled. Got an expert diabetologist to control her diabetes and her infection in the leg. Got an ophthalmologist after the control of the diabetes to look at her eye. We had to pay for a paid caregiver from our organization so that she could be admitted to the hospital and get her eye operated. And after 4 years, she saw her son again. Now, this is not what palliative care would do in the West. Of course, I admit that at least 2/3 of what we do here would be something like what they do in the West. But I would also say that we often have to compensate for the lack of reasonable primary, secondary, or tertiary care, especially in exceptional situations like this.
I was thinking, Dr. Raj, that we could go through some of these one by one. First, I wanted to ask, in the medical profession, where all do you see palliative care education and palliative care focus that needs to come in?
Everywhere, of course. But I'm glad to report that there have been several positive developments in this country. The latest being, from the batch that starts medical education in 2019, most aspects of palliative care are now officially in the curriculum. So maybe a quarter of a century later, the awareness of the average doctor and nurse about palliative care would be so much better than now. And that definitely will make a lot of difference. Right now, getting palliative care across to a reasonable number of people would mean introduction of palliative care education for existing doctors. There are people who are willing to learn, but that has to be made available more freely. That means the National Program for Palliative Care, which the government of India started in 2012, will have to be evaluated in detail, the shortcomings assessed, and improvements brought in, so that not only does the new medical student learn it, but existing medical and paramedical professionals are taught this. And understandably, they need help to make it part of their routine work. The one problem in our country is that the healthcare system is so desperately overloaded. And initially, the doctors might feel that here is one more straw on the camel's back, which was almost broken already. But on the other hand, after this training and incorporation into practice, the physicians and nurses may actually feel that their work is easier now and much more satisfying. So online and physical courses to train doctors and nurses in palliative care, incorporation of more paramedical staff into it, including medical social workers, physiotherapists and pharmacists, all this will pave the way to a better tomorrow. And the most important point that I have to add, that it is not expensive. Most of palliative care is low cost. I don't know if that's a problem, because unless it's high tech with a lot of gleaming machines and gadgetry, most things don't seem glamorous enough. But palliative care is low cost. It's affordable.
What you said reminds me of the few of us who are still fortunate to have good family doctors often find our family doctors to be a source of a lot of this palliative care, right?
Absolutely true. But I'm glad that you have a family doctor. That is so rare. If there is a health issue in a family, the members get together and ask, hey, whom should I go to? Oh, he has pain here. Should we go to a cardiologist or should we go to a gastroenterologist? That decision now has to be taken by the family. And the treatment to a large extent will decide on which specialist the patient sees first. The family physician is not a commonly seen human being anymore. And we do not have an effective family medicine training program either. So this curious situation has come where our primary care is deficient and super specialist care is booming, leaving a huge gap in actual care of the person.
And the other thing, Dr. Raj, from what you mentioned was that palliative care training is not just about education, but also about changing mindsets, right? So it's a huge mindset issue within the medical fraternity and perhaps within our Indian society as well that we need to do, along with specific training of skills and concepts.
Yes, I agree. But listen, we don't have to change everyone's mindset in one go. If only we gave the opportunity, a lot of compassionate healthcare providers would be doing an excellent job. I truly believe that the vast majority of healthcare providers are kind and compassionate human beings. The only problem is that they are not offered an opportunity. They are not given a permission to be compassionate. They are schooled in the art of turning away from suffering. Give them an opportunity. And maybe some people will not be interested. That's okay. A significant critical mass of healthcare providers, if given an opportunity, would turn towards compassionate care. They would turn towards incorporation of principles of palliative care into all their healthcare service.
Thank you for saying that. Could I also ask you about the role of medicines and drugs? And I think this is perhaps one thing we might have to spend a little more time on as well. But where do medicines come into this? Starting from the simple painkiller, like something like an ibuprofen, which is perhaps oversubscribed and overprescribed and overused in the country. But more serious pain relief medications for those in desperate need is just not available in India. So could you tell us about that?
This is a complicated issue. I'll tell you why I say this is complicated. Okay, we say that ibuprofen is often abused. Well, that may be too strong a word. Certainly irrationally used. I agree. This is not to say that all ibuprofen use is harmful or bad. It does have its role. Only thing is, today, that doesn't become the subject of study for the doctor. Secondly, if there were rational application of medical education and nursing education and schooling in the art of relieving pain, then within the existing laws and within the existing government programs, pain could be relieved at negligible cost. You mentioned the need for opioids. Opioids is the term used for medicines derived from opium or drugs that have similar composition and effects. We grow poppy in the North Indian states of UP, MP and Rajasthan. We make opium in our government factories and export most of it to Western countries so that they get pain relief and our own people are denied it. Our factories also make morphine, which is what we use in our practice, which is what is used by 170 institutions for pain relief in Kerala, and what is practically unavailable to the vast majority of people in India. So you need two things. One, you need education of professionals on proper use of painkillers. And secondly, you need balanced access to opioids. When I say balance, what it means is some of these medicines, the opioid medicines, are amenable to non-medical or recreational use, which can be a huge problem in itself. So balanced use means you make them available for pain relief and you keep enough controls to prevent their getting into the wrong hands. This is possible to be done. And the state of Kerala over the last 22 years has shown that this can be very easily done. And we only need to translate this into action. The law has been changed in 2014. Indian Parliament brought in a law which changed the old draconian act and brought in reasonable ballots. We only need implementation of the same.
Could I ask a few follow-ups on that, and could we take a minor detour into how painkillers work? So things like ibuprofen, what I think we call non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs or conventional painkillers that most of us are familiar with. Could you tell us the role of where all you see them applying and where you see insufficient use in the country? And where do more important painkillers, like there could be steroidal pain relief drugs, there could be opioids, where do they come in? And what kind of diseases, what kind of challenges are they vital in providing pain relief?
I fear that my answer may be very inadequate because there is a little too much of human physiology that has to be understood for the answer to be complete. Now, pain can be of different origins and different mechanisms. All pains are not treated with the same medicine. All pain management is almost invariably with a combination of several modalities. Say, for example, the pain in cancer is usually treated by a combination of non-opioid medicine, including ibuprofen or more commonly paracetamol, along with opioid medicines, weaker ones like tramadol or stronger ones like morphine. It's a combination, and what elements that combination you use in a particular person will depend on the type of pain that he has. So when we teach pain management, the first learning is about evaluation of the nature of the pain. Different pains need to be treated differently. There are some pains, indeed, which may respond better to your ibuprofen than to the morphine. But the vast majority of cancer pains will necessitate the use of opioids. So it is not a very simple answer which is better. It depends on the nature of the pain and on the particular individual.
So does that subjectivity and the need for a qualified medical professional to take that subjective call on when to prescribe some of these painkillers, is that what makes it difficult? Or is it a solved problem elsewhere?
There are protocols. We all go by protocols. But that application of the protocol necessitates a background knowledge of the physiology. Let me give you an example. Suppose somebody has a cancer in the lung. He would have pain over the chest and also, not uncommonly, pain in the upper arm, forearm and in the hand. Now, the pain locally could be caused by the cancer itself. It can be caused by the cancer eroding into the bones. It can be caused by accumulation of fluid within the lungs, outside the lungs. And each of these things will have to be assessed by the doctor. If it is fluid, the treatment is to take out the fluid. All your medicines will only worsen the issue. If it has eroded onto the ribs, it may need radiotherapy into the bone. It may warrant ibuprofen also. It may warrant morphine also. But with all these, the man's pain down the arm may not get relieved, because that is usually happening because the cancer has eaten into the nerves and is causing the pain. That requires a different combination of medicines, which include medicines that we use for treatment of convulsions, for treatment of depression, etc. Not because the person is depressed, but because that particular mechanism becomes important in the treatment. I'm sorry that sounds complicated, but we shouldn't try to oversimplify what may be a bit complicated. This is not too complicated for a medical or nursing person to understand. And that much of education is necessary to treat pain effectively. If you are asking, okay, can a layman look at a protocol and learn to treat pain adequately, my answer is maybe in about 10% of cases. In all the other 90% of cases, no.
Dr. Rajagopal, I wanted to ask specifically about morphine. So clearly these opioids are one of the last stages of pain relief medication that is currently available. And like you said in the beginning, these are not expensive drugs, right? So morphine is not available, or other such pain medication is not available to most Indians, not from a cost perspective, but purely from a legal and a regulatory and other perspective only. So is it something that we can truly provide at scale to all people in need without too much excessive extra expenditure?
Yes, but I hesitate over the answer, because we can be very ingenious to make anything expensive. Let me tell you why I say that. Simple morphine is inexpensive. An average patient with cancer can, in our unit, can get enough morphine for a day at less than 10 rupees. But that is not often available. Much too often, this is totally unethical. Much too often, what is available is a synthetic substitute that's very expensive, which is stuck on the skin so that it gets absorbed through the skin. This is called transdermal fentanyl. Mind you, it has its rightful place in some selected individuals. But when hospitals offer only this, saying that, morphine, that's old-fashioned, this is what we use, and give something that's 150 times as expensive, I am convinced nobody has any doubt. In fact, 64 organizations, they come together with a declaration that without offering inexpensive morphine, no institution should offer these expensive things. But it keeps happening all the time. But coming back to your question, if we limit the expensive formulations to only those who desperately need it, basic pain relief can be absurdly inexpensive.
That is remarkable. And even here, you mentioned that through your efforts and various efforts across the country, various institutions and medical professions coming together, and perhaps patient groups as well, we have tried to change the laws in India to permit the greater use and access of these last line pain relief medications like morphine and make them available to all. Why has that not translated to reality across the country? What is the barrier that is standing in between?
Very positive question. The answer is, we live in a country where a law is not necessarily followed. Look, I am making a big statement. I am aware of this, and I am taking responsibility for this statement. As I said, in 2014, the Indian Parliament changed the law. In 2015, the relevant rules were published and the formalities are complete. Even today, after 5 years, there are many states, in fact, the majority of states, where the law has not been implemented at all. There are states where which say, no, we will not follow that. We will follow our own rules, which is illegal. They don't even realize that what they are saying is illegal. All that we need to do is to implement the existing law.
I still want to get at why they want to do that. What would be the incentive? Is it again a mindset there? Is there a fear of abuse? Or is it just something that has escaped the imagination of our decision makers and even medical professionals who might be in such positions of decision-making power?
It's a combination of the mindset issue, resistance to change, and a lot of mistaken beliefs. The mindset, because you can be very philosophical about pain, so long as it is somebody else's pain. A true philosopher is one who laughs at pain. But as Shakespeare said, the philosopher who could ignore his own toothache still has not been born. Most human beings tend to ignore that somebody else's pain can be beyond one's power of imagination. So people say, pain, that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. Disease matters, pain doesn't matter. Yes, if it is somebody else's pain, because that person then thinks, okay, I had this broken arm. They gave me painkillers only for 1 day. I've managed. So why can't they manage? But the fact is, in some conditions, including cancer, pain can be beyond your imagination. Say, for example, let me give you an example. One of my patients said, when asked what his pain was like, he said what he felt was like somebody putting a nail into his ear and striking it with a hammer again and again. He said the hammering will go on for 10 minutes and then stop for a minute, few minutes, and then start again. He couldn't run away from the nails and the hammer. I have had a person who said what he felt was like somebody putting a red hot iron into his bones and twisting it all the time. So very often people do not understand that pain can be so excruciating. So excruciating that a lot of people attempt suicide to get away from it. That's one thing. Secondly, it's also fear of the unknown. People have heard about morphine and addiction. This includes doctors. You don't study about addiction and morphine as a subject in medical college. You only have heard these horrendous stories. And you know somebody who has actually had a teenager son who got addicted. So you have this fear of addiction. And then we hear all these dreadful news from USA. We don't recognize that the Western European countries have effectively used it without any problem or any significant problem. We only hear about the vant and careless use of it in USA and the resultant problems. So there is this the fear of addiction. And when people stop to listen, we are able to tell them, look, here is a simple way in which we can use it without diverting it to those illegal sources. Here is how we have done it in Kerala for 22 years without problem. So you can do that if somebody stops to listen. And particularly medical professionals have this, in our country, have this fear that even morphine is very dangerous. It stops the breathing. On the other hand, it is today the drug of choice for breathlessness in many medical situations in the appropriate dose. So, and the third reason is resistance to change. All change is resistant. That is human nature. Except by a minority of people who are always happy to change. So a new law has come in. Somebody has to study it, then implement it. It's easier not to do it at all. Just go on doing things the way you used to. So it's a question of mindset and callous indifference to pain and suffering. It's also irrational fear coming out of lack of knowledge about addiction. And it is also the resistance to change, the fact that it is simply easier to ignore the law because you can get away with it.
Thank you, Dr. Rajagopal. Let's take a quick break and come back to talk about your personal journey into palliative care, about COVID-19 and more. Welcome back to the Pragati podcast. We are talking to Dr. M.R. Rajagopal about palliative care in India. I wanted to ask you about your journey. You were an anesthetist. Before that, you were a medical student. How did you start thinking about palliative care at a time where probably almost nobody thought about it in India?
One small piece of correction. Palliative care had come to India well before I came into it. I just did not know about it. An oncosurgeon in Mumbai, his name is Dr. Lucinto D'Souza, had started a hospice, the Shanti Avedana Southern in Mumbai. I just did not know about it. My own journey was just seeing people suffering, including the suffering of a cousin when I was a medical student. Seeing the vast sea of suffering around me as a young doctor, and then becoming an anesthetist. Anesthesiology, fundamentally an attempt to relieve pain. That's how it starts. Pain during surgery. So the same modalities of treatment with a little bit of manipulation can be used to treat a lot of pain. When I became a head of the department in a government medical college in Calicut, I finally had a freedom to do some things on my own, and then I started treating people's pain. Only pain. I was very focused. I once treated a person, he was a college professor, 42, with a nerve block, putting in a chemical into his nerve so that his cancer pain was relieved. His pain was relieved. I was very happy. He went home and committed the suicide that night.
Wow.
What I did not know was what that man felt. I forgot that he was a human being. He had been told by his oncologist that hereafter your treatment will be in the other place. So he came to me. I gave this nerve block, treated his pain. He asked, when should I come again? I said the pain relief should last for about 3 to 6 months. If you get the pain again, then you come back to me. That was when he understood that he had no chance of cure. Till then, he had no idea. This was something conveyed to me by his cousin later. He went home and told his wife that I am finished. And that night, he committed suicide. He was my guru who gave up his life to teach me that a human being is not made only of nerves and muscles and things, that they have feelings, they have emotions, and a whole person needs treatment, not just a nerve. But later, my search for an answer took me to palliative medicine, which was already in existence in this world for more than 20 years. One British doctor, named Cicely Saunders, had started palliative care in the 1960s. And our own Dr. D'Souza had started hospice many years before I ventured into it. So I started treating pain. I did not have a lot of people to help me by way of staff, but common people came forward to help. If I am to take any credit, it's only that I just allowed people to come and help. Laymen came in to support the cause. The media was very enthusiastic. Several professionals also came forward to help. There was also a lot of opposition, but we managed. We formed a non-government organization to support the person and not just the nerve. And that's how it all started.
And now, Dr. Rajagopal, in both Pallium India and the Trivandrum Institute, what do you focus on and what do you work on directly? And how do you also enable other institutions to do some of this work and carry on the palliative care?
So in Trivandrum, we give patient care directly with our team of volunteers, nurses, social workers, pharmacists, physiotherapists, doctors. We all together look after people, maybe something like 1,500 patients at a time. They are seen mostly in their homes if they are bedbound. If they are ambulant, they come to the outpatient clinic. A few people whose problems cannot be solved at home, limited number of people are brought in as inpatients. Generally, our effort is to facilitate the person's life in their own environment, in their home. But this is what we do directly in Trivandrum. Elsewhere in the country, we look out for champions, interested institutions or interested professionals or others who are willing to start a palliative care service. We provide the training. We provide the know-how. We offer some hand-holding and work with them to develop palliative care services in their own places. We have done some work in 18 of India's states and 2 union territories. And a third major aspect of our work is advocacy. Wherever we have an opportunity, we work with governments to create palliative care policies, palliative care programs, to change laws where necessary, and to bring, if possible, bring bureaucrats, politicians, and professionals on the same table to chart out plans and actions.
Thank you so much, and I hope this journey continues and more states and more institutions start actually integrating palliative care into everything that they offer. Here, I want to come in and ask about what's happening right now in India and across the world, the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. We've seen how this pandemic affects so many people so differently, from people who feel no symptom to a minor cold or a minor fever to all the way in having pneumonia and needing critical care and even ending up on ventilators. In this gamut, where do you see the role of palliative care coming in?
Well, I don't think palliative care has been less relevant ever. COVID-19 is sheer suffering. Suffering and nothing else. You feel it. We feel the fear. That's why we are so religiously staying indoors, wearing masks. Even the person with only mild symptoms who recovers has gone through that period of isolation and the fear. That's also suffering. Okay. Those who get severe disease have major symptoms like breathlessness. A breathlessness is a very difficult symptom to endure. The feeling of not being able to take in enough air. And many people get delirious and agitated, especially the elderly. Unfortunately, the survival after ventilation is not expected to be good. A study came out from New York, from 12 hospitals together. They had dealt with some 5,700 patients, then the majority were still in hospital. But out of 320 patients who had come to a natural conclusion, only 11.9% of people had survived. 88.1% of those 320 had died. And the older you are, the greater the chance of death. Now, I know people don't talk about it. Governments do not talk about it much because they don't want to create panic. I understand their compassion, but I truly believe that it is ill-advised. Because we are afraid to talk about it, we are not seeking solutions. What should we be doing? There should be much more counseling. Everybody is afraid of the unknown. If somebody is afraid, they should be asked, what are you afraid about? And you then find that most of the fears are about non-existent things. Many fears can be alleviated just by proper explanations. And people are understandably afraid of isolation. Can simple technology not help? Getting them to meet families electronically as much as possible. Okay, and then about the seriously ill people. Look, death is the inevitable consequence of life. It may happen. But we have the responsibility to make sure that it is as compassionate as possible. Now, if somebody is breathless, today's Indian doctor thinks only about ventilator as the treatment. That is not scientific. That is not true. What should happen and what actually happens in many Western countries is a process of triage. That's one expert team, with maybe a nurse-led team or a doctor. The doctor actually physically present all the time or at least as a consultant. Assess the person. See what are the chances of success. People of my age, the elderly, are more amenable to serious consequences. Especially if we have associated diseases like a kidney disease or liver disease, etc. So if artificial ventilation is only going to cause more suffering, I need to know what's happening to me. If I am asking questions, tell me the truth. And if you give me the truth, I will then say what I want. It's a rare chance that I might say, look, you still put me on a ventilator. Even if the chance is only 0.1%, I still want to fight it out. I am more likely to be sorry, certainly. I am more likely to say, just make me less breathless and say goodbye to my family for me. And with medicines, we can treat the symptoms. But now I am talking about those who are beyond hope of survival. But even for the others, all the others, palliative care still is necessary as part of treatment. Lot of people have muscle pains. Even today, the protocols do not spell out, except the protocols that we palliative care people have created, do not spell out what exact medications are to be used and how much. The protocols do not yet spell out what medicines are to be used for breathlessness or delirium. Of course, palliative care people have brought them out, but that's not used widely. So integration of palliative care into COVID care is absolutely necessary. The need of the day, ostensibly to prevent panic, not talking about it is going to cause a mountainous suffering tomorrow.
Thank you so much, Dr. Raj. I mean, this is so important. When we are talking about the health of our loved ones, we often think about, are they suffering or not? And even in our conversation, in our dialogue, the idea of suffering is common and the idea of trying to prevent suffering is common. And it is unfortunate to see such a big gap between that and the reality of the kind of healthcare that we receive. And I'm so happy that you are fighting this long fight, this marathon, and running this marathon to bridge that gap. I just wanted to ask if I've heard stories of how there are some hospitals in the West which have made their hospitals and ICUs more colorful environments so that people don't feel trapped within that space, but actually feel like it's more open.
You know, this is a general question about intensive care units themselves. Now, instead of being closed, cold rooms with only machinery and bleeps and noises, if we can make them as humane as possible. Now, what I'm going to say may not be applicable to the COVID situation where isolation is necessary.
Right.
But I understand that 27% of intensive care units in USA welcome families to come in and visit. And I've personally seen an intensive care unit in San Francisco where there's a couch by the side of the patient's bed for a family member to lie down in and rest. So there is no science behind this exclusion of families from intensive care units. The ostensible reason is to prevent infection, but all that it requires is the basic screening process and some personal protection. And then the presence of families would make so much a difference. Well, that's about making IC units more friendly.
Right.
The more like home it seems to the patient. Say, for example, if there's a clock in front of you when you lie down at night, having the same clock against you would make the place a little more familiar to the person and lessen the chance of delirium. That's all true. Yes, I believe intensive care units shouldn't look after only the heart and the brain and the lungs. Intensive care units should also look at human beings as human beings.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rajagopal. Any parting thoughts for our listeners and for us to keep in mind as we go on this journey of improving palliative care for all Indians?
I think today, all healthcare systems are ignoring suffering and sometimes inflict avoidable suffering. Healthcare needs to include mitigation of suffering. And perhaps each one of us also needs to think about this, even when we think about our own loved ones. How many of our grandparents are leading lonely lives? A little bit of companionship could make such a lot of difference to a lot of lives around us. We all need to consider relief of suffering, our responsibility. And also remember, learning from tens of thousands of volunteers in my state of Kerala, that the community has a responsibility to support those who are suffering around us. The medical system can do only so much. Much of social, emotional, and spiritual suffering can be taken care of if the community accepts the responsibility and compassionate people get together to relieve the suffering of others.
Thank you, Dr. Rajagopal, for coming on the Pragati podcast. It was an absolute privilege to have you talk to us at length. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thank you for staying with us till the end. If you have any questions or comments, do write in to podcast@thinkpragati.com. And hey, if you like the podcast and listen to us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating and a review. It'll mean a lot to us. The Pragati podcast is available on the IVM podcast app and pretty much every other podcast app and platform. We are there everywhere.